Hey there, freedom fighters and wantrepreneurs. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And I say wantrepreneurs because I'm hoping that there's some out there in the audience who are listening to this interview, because I think you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. This is the story of a wantrepreneur who finally launched and grew a business. Peter Keller says he's always been risk averse and hesitated to start a business. Then in 2010, something happened and he finally launched Fringe Sport, which designs and manufactures strength and conditioning equipment. Fringe Sport brings its products to market through the e-commerce and bricks and clicks approach. We're going to find out how he did it. This interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Who is Scott? You probably know by now. Scott is the lawyer that entrepreneurs trust. I'll tell you later why. If you're an entrepreneur who needs a lawyer, or an entrepreneur who's starting a company and doesn't think he needs a lawyer, why you need to go to walkercorporatelaw.com and talk to Scott. But first, I got to welcome Peter. Thanks for doing this interview.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andrew.
You recognized that you were a wantrepreneur when you were in the trunk of your dad's SUV. What were you doing there that made you realize that you're not in the right place in your life?
Well, so this was in 2010. My dad was living in Kuwait, and I was actually visiting him. At the time, I had had a number of different internet ventures that I'd launched, but had all, I'd say, failed, but at the time, they didn't even feel like failures. They just felt like they never got off the ground, mm-hmm. because I was always holding a piece of me back. I wasn't really investing fully into them, and this is with the benefit of hindsight. And I think I wasn't doing that because I was afraid of failure, afraid that if I put all in and then it failed, that I'd be a failure.
Give me an example of a business that you didn't put enough of yourself into, and then we're going to get back to your trunk.
Oh, yeah, no. Please, the trunk.
Got to.
So one example is I launched a website called mygaragegym.com, which actually had a vision somewhat similar to what I'm doing now with Fringe Sport, except all we were doing was drop shipping strength and conditioning equipment products. And rather than, you know, go all in on that, I just kind of did it on the side and didn't really give it the care, the feeding, the, you know, financial support that it needed. So it never got off the ground.
What's one thing that you should have done that you didn't do because you weren't 100% committed to it? Give me an example so I really get to see what you're talking about.
Oh, man. I mean, the number one thing would be just be proud and be loud of what I was doing. I was doing it as a side project for my main business, and I was like, oh, well, I'm going to be in stealth mode, and I'm just going to kind of launch small and, you know, quietly work on SEO and quietly work on the PPC and stuff like that. And the point was, it was just quiet. You know, nothing ever went there. Traffic was always really low, and I never really...
Did you actually do your SEO? Did you actually do any of that work?
I did. What I did then compared to what I do now is... worlds
what's one
different.
Thing that you do now that's world apart that back then would have at least got you off the ground?
So one of the things that's been actually successful for Fringe is, so Fringe Sport is very strong in the CrossFit market. Mm-hmm. I'm a CrossFitter and all of my employees are. So one of the things about this market is that it's very social media savvy and has been for, you know, a number of years. So one of the things that's been successful for us is reaching out to bloggers, to people who have strong followings on social media and other people like that, and either giving them free products or even just reaching out and just saying, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what you're doing. Is there some way we could come together? And then that creates, you know, goodwill, but it also creates inbound links.
I see. And back then, you were going to quietly do SEO instead of emailing someone and saying, I am running a business in this space. Can we work together? And as a result of the change, I can see that you're on garagegyms.com, for example, and other sites have linked and talked about you. All right, and we'll get to all of that. So I see you were holding back. You were thinking you were doing work. You were tricking yourself into thinking that you were really an entrepreneur, but really you weren't talking to people. You were just doing busy work maybe with this whole SEO thing on the quiet. You were in the trunk, and what were you reading at the time?
So this, I think, at this time is very cliche, but I was reading the 4-Hour Workweek. And when I was reading the 4-Hour Workweek, we were driving through the desert, just kind of bouncing around, and I was in the trunk because it was kind of a family trip to go visit my father, and there wasn't enough room for me in the car because I was kind of a late-minute addition, and so I said, hey, I'll sit in the trunk. And I had grabbed 4-Hour Work Week on a whim because a number of different friends had recommended it to me. And I finally said, okay, fine, I'll read it. And as I was reading it, all this stuff started to come together in my mind. And this, what Tim was writing about was really coalescing a lot of thoughts that I had had before, but never really had coherently, if that means anything. And in kind of a bolt from the blue, I thought, you know, I'm just screwing around. You know, I'm using entrepreneur, and I didn't know the word entrepreneur at the time. I think now it's becoming more popular, but I thought that I'm playing at entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. This is a hobby. It's not a business. It makes me feel good to have these little, you know, websites up, and I can, like, you know, feel like, oh, I'm Peter Keller, the entrepreneur, but I wasn't actually fighting it out, duking it out in the marketplace where success or failure really happens. And so at that point, I decided I either need to stop being a entrepreneur, stop these little ventures or whatever that, you know, are leeching a little bit of money, a little bit of time here and there, and focus on my corporate job, which I had a very nice corporate job at the time, mm-hmm. or I need to have a real burn the ships type of moment where it's like, this is a go and there's no looking back. And if it's a failure, it's a failure.
I see, by the way, but what if you're looking at me and see, and it looks like my eyes are all over the place, is because I'm taking a look, now that you've given me a little bit to look at, I'm taking a look at mygaragegym.com, and you know who created mygaragegym.com? Admin. I see admin here. I mean, I went to the About Us page. I said, I'll get to read it. And now I see the About Us page is admin, as opposed to now do you put your face on the site? I don't see
Sorry,
it.
You skipped away there.
Sorry?
You skipped a minute there, the audio.
Oh, I'm saying, now are you on the site? Is it more about you on the site?
On My Garage Gym?
On Fringe Sport. My Garage Gym was created by admin. You can email admin at mygaragegym.com if you have anything to say.
I might email him. If I can speak to myself in the past, it might save me a few mistakes. But on Fringe Sport, if you go to the About Us page, mm-hmm. then it does actually talk about us. It because I founded Fringe with my brother.
And so I see. There we go. Fringe Sport was founded 2010 by Peter and Alex. Alex is your brother, so you're really now starting to stand up. I see. All right. So now you're reading this book. You had this idea all along. You wanted to sell equipment online. You're going to do it right. What's the first step that you take in this new, more correct path?
So the first step that I took, and I had a lot of product design and sourcing experience from my employer at the time, which is now my previous employer, of course. And I thought, you know what, dropshipping works for some people, but I actually need to bring in some of my own product, actually have it in my garage, so that every time I go out in my garage to go to work or to go for a run or whatever, I see with my own eyes that there's boxes sitting on my floor. Because if I don't sell them, there's still going to be boxes sitting
on my floor. I see. This is the burn the ships thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That you cannot trick yourself into thinking that you don't have it. And if your money is in on this and it's in your house, you have to. You're forced to sell it at some price. Even if it means you have to sell it on Craigslist, you have to sell it.
Exactly.
Got it.
And my wife will also see it if it's in the garage. So, you know, honey, if I can't park my car in here, you need to be doing something.
And before you even made a sale, you quit your job?
No. So we did actually do it on the side for a whole year, okay. Slightly over a year. And then we both quit our jobs and went in whole hog. I guess at this point, my burn the ships moment was, you know, giving my heart to it and deciding that, you know, there's not going to be any excuses here. Fringe Sport or whatever the venture, you know, is, which turned out to be Fringe, is going to get all of me.
Why did you need Alex to be a part of this?
So I'm a very family-oriented guy. It was always my dream to have a family business, honestly, and wanted to be in it with him. The other part of it was that at the time I was the vice president of another internet company. I had a lot going on there. And even while I was doing my own business on the side that, like I said, I'm going to give my whole heart to and work hard on, it wasn't possible for me to let things slide at my day job. I mean, if I was taking a paycheck, I felt like that would be really disingenuous to let things slide and to not take care of everything that I needed to there.
I see.
And so one of the pitches that I made to Alex, because Alex is 10 years younger than I am, and he was actually going to college at the time, I said, look, you know, you have your, and he's a really smart, talented, hardworking guy. And I knew that he was going to do well no matter what. And I said, look, you can have your whole life to be an employee. You know, you're a smart guy. You're going to be able to get a job. You know, why don't you take a flyer on this thing? And, you know, worst case, it's a failed business. And then you'll go to business school and, you know, it'll be more interesting on your application than most of the other people. Best case, we are where we are. But he helped me a lot on, you know, just a lot of the marketing side, a lot of the helping to figure things outside. And honestly, emotionally as an entrepreneur, when things are going bad or things aren't, you know, clicking where they need to be, it was helpful from that side as well.
And honestly, I'm really glad you said that. Later on, we're going to talk about that. And one of the things that I'm excited to hear about is, maybe excited is not the right word, I'm proud that you're willing to talk about these inner issues that we have. And we're going to get to that later on. You then needed to get the product. How do you get enough product into your house?
So I'm very lucky in that with my previous company, I actually was involved in launching a new private label brand for them. And this was in appliances.
Can I say the name of the company? I don't think it's a secret.
Living Direct. And to be honest, livingdirect.com, also at compactappliance.com, they were really, really great to me. Sometimes I feel a little weird about saying their name because I don't know how it is. But they were very great to me, and I wish those guys all of the best.
It's a great company to come from if what you want to sell is physical products. That's what they do. I'm looking at their site right now. They have kegerators. They have air conditioners. We're not talking about little things that you send through the mail. We're talking about real stuff, just like you with barbells. All right, so you said you learned something about how to get products from working there. What did you learn that you can pass on to us?
Oh, yeah. And honestly, I started sourcing product and making product in 2005. Now, almost 10 years later, it's so much easier. So one of the very first things that I would say, and this goes into my attitude towards entrepreneurs now, which is a bit evolved from what it was before, which is, you know, stop wanting to do something. So number one thing is just start. Now, if you want to make a physical product, there are so many more resources available to you now than there were before. I do blog a little bit at productsimple.net about how to source and design physical products. There's also another place that I'm fairly active is the Entrepreneur subreddit on Reddit, where you can get help.
That's a really good subreddit. But
I like that sub quite a bit.
But give me one thing that you did right back then so we can learn from your experience here today.
So the one thing that I did right was actually, and I mentioned this before, you know, getting the product in and putting it on my floor so that I had a physical reminder of it every day. And one of the things that I would say is if you can do this, if you can go to Alibaba or globalsources.net or something like that and find the product that you're looking for, just go ahead. If it's not too expensive, go ahead and take the plunge and then try to sell that thing.
I see. I thought that you were going to, because you worked for livingdirect.com, that you had some inner connection for where to source product. No, you're telling me Alibaba, globalsources.net, the kind of resources that the rest of us have access to, that's where you went online and you said, I need to stock my gym from there. Gymnastic rings, is that what you started with?
It is.
Why?
I started with gymnastic rings because of the minimum order quantity required and then the cost of the gymnastic rings, the amount of money that I'd have to invest, and then the margin that I would potentially be able to sell those at when I got them in. So through Alibaba, I found a supplier for gymnastic rings. At the time in the US, there were only maybe three companies selling gymnastic rings online, and they were all selling the gymnastic rings for $50 to $75. And to be very clear and honest, I could get the gymnastic rings in for about $15 a pair or something like that, a little bit more maybe. And so there was a pretty big gap between how much it would cost me to get those things landed onto my garage floor and then what I could potentially, based on the market, sell them for.
I see.
And then the minimum order quantity was small enough. I think I started with 100 pairs of rings. So all in, I was in about $2,000. Which, you know, I wasn't a rich man, but, you know, I had $2,000 that I could invest in this.
And you were selling them each for $45, according to the site, from what I can see. That, free shipping both ways, like Zappos.
There you go. Free shipping both ways. So I figured all in, I'm in about $2,000, and worst case, just kind of like you alluded to before, I'll liquidate these things on Craigslist or, you know, sell them on a street corner or something like that. And then that way I get my money back if it was a failure, and I'd just be like, okay, well, I learned something.
Peter, this is fantastic. For entrepreneurs out there, you're giving them so much direction. First of all, you're saying, accept your entrepreneur. Stop kidding yourself about the fact that you created all these other businesses or all these business cards that you have sitting in a drawer somewhere. If you're an entrepreneur, it's okay to accept it. It doesn't mean that your life has to end up that way. It's not like being 5'7", that for the rest of your life, you're going to be around 5'7". You have a chance to do something about it. Number one, accept it. Number two, do something bold. And in your case, it was buy the stuff and put it in the house. We're not talking about $100,000 worth of equipment that sits around the house. For $2,000, you had it sitting around the house and you put it up on a website. Here's the other thing that I learned about you. Again, I'm on the site. On the very bottom part of the site, it says powered by Shopify. Right? Easy, basic, off the shelf. Why did you pick Shopify as opposed to any other platform?
So funny you should mention Shopify. I came from an e-commerce background, and I actually was a web designer before, and I have a lot of experience with a lot of other platforms online, but I'm a Shopify evangelist. And Shopify doesn't pay me. In fact, I pay them, but I really love that platform. And the reason that I picked it then is because I realized early on that our web platform was not going to be our competitive advantage. So we needed to go with somebody that was SEO friendly, that was friendly to our customers in terms of, you know, how the shopping cart works, how to check out, you know, category nav structure, and that made it easy to make the website look at least pretty good. Because actually, I don't think that our website is the nicest looking website that I've ever seen. It's not even in the top 100 by any stretch of the imagination, but it does what it needs to do. And then Shopify gets out of your way and lets you do the marketing, lets you do the hustling, lets you do the sales.
Gotcha. So they can't talk to Nerd Fitness and get Nerd Fitness to somehow link to you. You have to do that, but what they can do is make sure that customers' credit cards go where they need to, make sure that the order process is clean and easy for people to navigate. All right, I like the simplicity of it. So Shopify, just use off-the-shelf solutions. So many times people want to hire a developer for the first version. You just use Shopify. And frankly, I just checked the site right now. On the very bottom, it still says, powered by Shopify.
And we're proud of it.
All right, I want to do a quick plug here for Scott Edward Walker, because I think it's important to talk about the legality of putting a business together, especially if you're doing it with another co-founder, and especially if that co-founder is your brother. And then we're going to get into what you did to now bring traffic into your store. But did you and your brother have any kind of agreement in place for who owned the business, for what share you owned the business? Did you at all? And I'll do that, and then we'll get into Walker corporate law.
So we had essentially a handshake agreement, which wasn't really even a handshake agreement. It was just a, you know, hey, we're brothers. Hey, let's do this thing together. This is absolutely 100% the wrong way to do it. I will never, ever do this again. And as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about this.
Why? What's the problem with doing it that way?
Sorry?
What's the problem with doing it that way?
So the problem with doing it that way is that in the start, when you're in the honeymoon period, because you're like, let's do a business. Yeah, we're going to do a business. We're going to take over the world. And everybody has, you know, all of these good feelings. The hard work hasn't set in yet. The grind hasn't set in yet. The fact that one partner is going to do something that pisses the other partner off, the other partner is going to, you know, either seethe quietly or retaliate or whatever. And by the way, these are completely normal.
Even you and your brother had it.
Absolutely.
What did he do to you, and what did you do to him?
So there's just at different times during the growth of the business, you know, I've felt like, oh, I'm putting more of myself into the business, or I'm more important to the business. And then at other times, he's, and maybe even the same time when I'm feeling that I'm more important to the business, he's feeling the same thing on his side. And so it creates friction between founders has a serious detrimental effect on the business as a whole. So one of the things, to go back to what you had mentioned, getting adequate counsel, someone who's been there, done that, to help sketch you out and write down a number of things, your articles of incorporation, your partnership agreement, a buy-sell agreement, you know, things like that, are extremely important from an early stage. So one of the things that you had mentioned before when we were talking about Shopify about, hey, you don't need to hire a dev and do a custom site. You absolutely do not. And unless you're doing, I don't know, something amazing and fantastic and new, I would definitely go with an off-the-shelf solution there and save your money and work on something else. I would not go with an off-the-shelf solution in terms of your legal needs if you're really serious about this entrepreneurship thing.
And you know what? And frankly, it doesn't have to cost as much as I used to think it would be. It would cost, because it's a lot of labor, a lot of time for the lawyer to put it together. It doesn't have to be as complicated as I thought it would be. I just assumed it was going to be really tough. How do you make sure that everyone's shares are done right? How do you make sure that no one's getting too much, that it really evens out, or that it makes sense even 3 years in the future? It turns out the cost is lower than a lot lower than I thought, because lawyers like to help entrepreneurs get going, to build a relationship with them. And it's not as complicated, because tons of other companies, tons of other entrepreneurs have done it. If you work with a lawyer who's worked with other entrepreneurs, he's got it now at this point. Anyway, I introduced a friend of mine to Scott Edward Walker. Walker Corporate Law helped them get started. The cost was really reasonable for putting it together, and it didn't take up much time at all. And I recommend to anyone out there that if you're looking for a lawyer, Scott Edward Walker is really the guy you go to when you have big transactions like selling your company, buying a company, raising money, etc. But even in the early stage, they'll be there for you to help you get started and to really make sure that you do it right, so that you don't have problems butting heads with your co-founder, so that you don't end up resenting each other, so that you don't end up making a mistake that really should not take your eye off of the ball, but could potentially if it's not done right. So talk to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I'll give you a website. It's walkercorporatelaw.com. All right, back to our story. You've got this website up. You have supply. You have the stuff at home. You know what you're doing. It's time to now bring people in the door. This can trip a lot of people up. How did you get your first customers?
So I came from a pay-per-click marketing background. That's what Living Direct had done really well, was pay-per-click. So that is number one, one of the very first things that we did, which, by the way, I would not repeat that.
Why not? Why wouldn't you buy ads?
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry?
Why wouldn't you buy ads, especially if you're so good at it?
Well, so that's the thing. Pay-per-click moves so fast. It's like playing craps at a casino. If you don't know what you're doing, you're going to lose a lot of money very, very quickly. If you do know what you're doing, it's actually a great channel for getting traffic. And
but you
for
did know what
sales.
You were doing. What?
Yeah.
And I'm looking, by the way, it doesn't seem like you guys buy ads right now. You're not doing any search ads, right?
We are, actually.
You are? Okay, I can't tell. Yeah. I'm glad that I asked you. So how did you figure it out?
So we actually went with a outside company to manage that. We were initially handling that in-house, and then when it started to get really good, which right now it delivers on an ROI basis very strongly for us. But we were initially doing it in-house and, you know, acquiring customers that way. We actually did work well for us, but I just think that for a startup there's probably
better. So what did you do that made it work well for you?
So diving into the analytics, understanding extremely clearly what the analytics are, understanding what your margins are, or in our case, our margins were, and then understanding what our business model was for acquiring and retaining those customers. So one of the things to mention about this really quickly is that a lot of people, when you talk with a lot of consultants in the PPC realm, they'll talk with you about lifetime value of a customer and trying to get you to be comfortable with losing money on that first sale to acquire the customer, because you're going to get it back in the back end. And maybe this is a good strategy, but for us as a bootstrap company, we didn't want to go with that strategy. We wanted to make sure that we're making money on the first sale.
Do you remember
making money?
Because you're a bootstrap company, cash is an issue. Cash flow is always an issue in a situation like this, especially if you're buying up front. Huge issue for you.
Yeah.
So do you remember one of the keywords that worked for you, or a distinction that you made that we can learn from? Do you remember anything from the first few weeks of doing AdWords?
So, you know, the more targeted the keyword, and then the more, like, And I know if anybody's a PPC person, they're probably going to start rolling their eyes when I say this stuff. But the more targeted the keyword, and then making sure that you're going after keywords that are buying focused rather than people that would just be looking for like general information. So, for example, our first products were gymnastic rings. And this would be a super, you know, facile example, but the keyword buy gymnastic rings is obviously a really targeted keyword that's going to deliver very targeted traffic. Whereas a keyword that might be similar, like gymnastic rings exercises, is not really somebody who's looking to buy gymnastic rings.
Gotcha.
So making sure that you're targeting the appropriate keywords that you're doing, and I can't remember exactly what the term is, but you're making negative keywords on the keywords that you don't want to show up, or you don't want your ads to show up.
Do you remember one of the negative keywords that you did not want your ads to show up on?
I think maybe exercises, because I think, you know, that didn't perform, and it was generally people who either already had a product or were thinking about buying a product, but were more interested in finding out what you could do with the product versus, you know, purchasing that product.
All right. I think getting into the specifics of what you did with AdWords is outside the scope of this interview. For now, what I will do is I'll take what you just said as useful information, but I'll also just emphasize the fact that you worked for a company where you did this. So many times, entrepreneurial podcasts will put down people who get a job, and entrepreneurs will put down other people if they have a job, because if you have a job, it means that you're not a real entrepreneur and all that. I see over and over again, entrepreneurs learned on someone else's dime, learned by working at another company, learned by being trained at another company, and then they used it to get maybe even almost an unfair advantage because they got to see, to look inside a company. And in your case, you did that. So I'll leave that out there. It's just another point to make sure that people take away from this. All right.
If I can comment on that really quick, I'm a big, big, big believer in that. To be honest, I think, so I started the business when I was, I think, 30 years old, and that would have made my brother, my partner, 20 years old. There's a world of difference between 20 and 25 and 30 in how seasoned you are and how mature you are and what you know, not only about entrepreneurship, but just about people and about social dynamics and things like that. And I'm really happy for the experience that I got at Living Direct, which was an entrepreneurial company. They had $3 million in revenue when I started there. And when I left as VP, they were notching over $50 million a year in revenue. And so the company was extremely entrepreneurial, and I was able to learn in a lot of different areas. And if that's what you want to do, I would strongly suggest finding a company that's going through those entrepreneurial growing pains, and then you can learn, and as you said, make mistakes on somebody else's dime, because I made a lot of mistakes on their time and learned from it.
Yeah.
So,
and get some guidance early on. All right. So ads were working for you. Let's see what else. CrossFit, you mentioned that. How did you start tapping into the CrossFit population?
So this is an interesting one, because it's a little bit prickly, because CrossFit is a trademark term, and so we always have to be careful about how we use it. But we are definitely CrossFitters. Our equipment is used by a lot of people who do CrossFit. And what we did to get more involved there is I was already personally involved in the community locally in Austin and online prior to starting the business, because, you know, what person in the gym ends up on Facebook, or, you know, what's the first rule of CrossFit, you know, all I'm supposed to be about on Facebook. I mean, it's such an online connected community. So I was already very involved in that prior to starting Fringe, and I just deepened my involvement with that. And that honestly is one of the reasons that I started Fringe, is that I was very passionate about physical fitness, sport, and the CrossFit movement. And I wanted a way to bring my passion and my work and my entrepreneurship coincide. So what we started doing is we started going out to events and going out to gyms and just straight up hustling. And that's one of the things we talk about being an entrepreneur. Being a wantrepreneur, I think a lot of wantrepreneurs are not adverse to work. They may be very hard workers, but they may be adverse to hustling, which I differentiate from work, because I think hustling is actually, you know, working hard to try and get an edge and try to get ahead, and, you know, doing things that a lot of people may not consider. You know, work is like, you know, doing SEO on your site, you know,
on your site in stealth mode. Hustling is going into gyms in Austin, giving out, what did you give out there?
So we gave out free gymnastic rings at the start to, you know, owners of gyms or trainers or things like that. And, you know, a lot of them were my friends already. Like, hey, you know, how you doing, brother? I started this business. It's called Fringe Sport. We're developing these gymnastic rings. Here's a free pair. You know, I'd love it if you would let me know what you think about it. And if you like it, I know you have a blog. You know, a quick post, a couple of pictures would be great. Even if you don't like it, you know, whatever, please give me the feedback because I need to know.
Peter, this is hustling and it takes guts. If I were to say to people, it takes guts to do it, they would almost brush it off. They would say, of course not. You just go in. It's easy. But when you actually have to do it, to walk in and talk about your business, your mind starts to play games with you. Things like, well, this guy doesn't need me. He has tons of suppliers. This guy does. I don't know how I'm going to get to the right person. Or what if I give it to him and he doesn't end up buying? Like, all these head games that we play with ourselves keep us from doing it. And I know that there are a lot of people who pretend that they don't have it. You have it. If you guys are out there pretending, I know you're pretending to yourself. You're lying to yourself. We all have it. And I think it's impressive that you got past it to the point where you were able to go into a gym and give it. Did it work, giving out free rings?
Absolutely.
It did. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, and it only worked 20% of the time, but, but I mean, that's what you're doing. You're running a numbers game. You know, not every time is going to work. And honestly, even in those early stages, there were some people who I considered, you know, good friends of mine who had, you know, big followings who I was like, oh, this guy's going to help me out for sure. Cause we've been friends for 3 years. And then, you know, there were a number of cases like that where nothing came through and I was like, oh crap, you know, what's wrong there? But then somebody from out of nowhere would, you know, say, oh, I love the rings. I love Fringe Sport. I love Peter and Alex, and I'm going to do anything I possibly can to help push them forward. And then that, I would seize onto that, and that would give me momentum. And that would say, hey, you know, we need to find more people like this. We need to connect with more people like this. And honestly, by the way, if there's any way I could help these people out in the future, like,
more people like this, right? You want to see what's working for you and double down on that instead of trying to endlessly make things that never work out for you turn around. So what's one thing that worked for you early on that you went in and doubled down on?
So I would say that providing killer service. I mean, this is kind of a cliche, but when I had founded the business, I wanted to pattern after Zappos, after Nordstrom, after REI. And honestly, Zappos and REI are two companies that I shop at quite a bit, and I really enjoy those companies. And so I had this idea that, hey, if we provide knock your socks off service, it's really going to make a difference in customers coming back. And it actually really did make a difference. As you saw on our website, we do free outbound and free return shipping, and we are literally shipping weights. And so, you know, it's really expensive.
Really
because
expensive.
And if somebody wants to ship the weights back, it's like no problem whatsoever. I mean, we do keep good analytics on all this stuff, like why are people shipping it back, you know, that sort of thing. And as of yet, we've never cut a customer off, even though we have a few customers who almost rent stuff from us.
You mean they're just buying it, they're trying it out, and they're going, you know what, I don't know the Spring Sport people. I'm just going to send it back to them, get my money back, and try something else.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that they're like, oh, I love Fringe Sport because I can get this barbell, I can use it for 2 months, and then I can send it back and get a new one. So, but that's cool. No problem whatsoever.
No, it's not. That's not cool, but it's acceptable. We'll deal with it. All right. One of the challenges that you had was that this business wasn't set it and forget it. You know, it feels to me like people who read 4-Hour Work Week think everything needs to be an automated business that they could run from the beach 4 hours a day, 4 hours a week tops. This wasn't like that.
No. And actually, so I had talked about 4-Hour Work Week before. So I do love that book because it brought everything together for me. But I think that book is about 40% just utter horse crap.
Okay.
and you know, 60% like solid gold.
What's the horse crap?
I was not super enthused even now to see kind of a lot of Tim's stuff about how to like fool your bosses into
thinking that you're working when you want to know something. I didn't think that worked either. I had a past guest email me afterwards and say, I did that. I don't want to say it. I didn't want to say it in the interview, but when I was working and I told you that I ran my company while I was working, what I did was I hired an outsourcer to do my job for me.
Wow.
But I don't think it's one of the most used ideas in the book. Outsourcing is, but not necessarily without telling your boss.
Yeah.
All right. So back to automation then. Your business couldn't be automated, right?
No, it couldn't be automated. And I did have the idea when we started the business that it would be that we would potentially outsource fulfillment to a supply house, which a lot of people do, and we would outsource a lot of these different things and then automate them as best we could, and then, you know, go on a beach and sip Mai Tais or something like that. But it became clear after a year that this was never going to happen in terms of automating the business and making a, you know, true 4-hour work week style business. But what I did see after about a year was that the business could be really great as a more traditional business, and then B, if I moved on to ideas from another book, which is The E-Myth Revisited, then the business actually, let's say, could be automated, but automated with systems, processes, and people.
Give me an example.
A great example is that I'm here in Taipei right now. I've been in Taipei for the past week. I'm going to be in China. I'm flying to Shanghai tonight. I'm going to be in China for the next week. So I haven't been at the business for a week, and I'll be gone for 2 weeks total. My brother actually is in Las Vegas right now. And when he gets back from Las Vegas, he's going to be in the office for a few days, and then he's going to fly to London. And Vegas is work. London is a holiday. But so he and I are kind of constantly coming and going.
I wonder how you did that. And I do that too at Mixergy. I used to think that this is so high touch. It's so about what I need to understand from the guest that I can't ask someone else to do it. And I can't get someone else to really understand the guest and do, for example, pre-interview. I thought for sure pre-interview would never be done. And then one of my past guests, Owen McCabe Anau, said, "You could do this." And then he almost wanted to tear the pre-interview away from me to prove it to me. And he forced me to sit down and say, okay, what are some of the questions I need to know? And now you went through the pre-interview process, and I didn't have to do it the way I did when I started out. There's a process. There's a doc that goes along with it. What's one thing that you didn't think you could have someone else do that now you've been able to delegate?
You know, that's a tough question because I focus really hard on only me doing the things that provide high value into the business. So let's just say, for example, sourcing and designing product. Like, that's something that I really hang my hat on personally, as it's a personal strong point and skill that I've got. But I have an employee who's back in Austin now. He actually worked for us while living in Shanghai for a year, and I've been trying to just funnel and pour all of my knowledge in this.
How did you do it using the E-Myth Michael Gerber approach?
So if your listeners aren't familiar with the E-Myth Revisited, one of the key tenets there is to run your business like it's a franchise, which is to say that there's essentially a binder, which in our case is Google Docs, of what to do in every situation. And so what we do is we have Google Docs that say, if this happens, then do this. If this happens, then do this. And complete training on every different aspect of the business. And so the employees can always refer to those Google Docs. And because they're online in a Google Doc format, they can actually search, you know, just use a keyword search like, hey, this is what I'm trying to do. Now, one thing, when I say this, this is always a constant work in process, in progress. I'm not going to sit here right now if any of my employees are watching and being like, hey, we're not perfect, because of course we're not. But it's a work in progress. But just start writing everything down. Like, how do you do things? Create template documents. You can even create checklists and things like that through Google Docs, and use that to have your employees walk through the different things. Because a lot of, let's say, like, you know, sourcing and maintaining these relationships with factories, that can be really high touch. But what I did is I make a lot of the initial relationships, and then I actually move my employee in, and I've taught him how to deal with factories and how to deal with people, and then he takes over a lot of the relationship. And so it's a lot of investment in time early on. But again, right now, I'm not going to see the office. I'm going to be 2 weeks out of the office right now. And probably over the year, I probably spend 3 or 4 months of the year outside the office, whether being on holiday or traveling for business. And the business continues to run itself because of the standard operating procedures, because of and processes, and because of the people who are implementing those processes.
So we use templates too. The pre-interview outline is templated out, and all we do is we copy a Google Doc that has it and we start a conversation with you. And we use Google Docs also because it's so easy to edit that you can't help yourself. If you see a mistake, you're going to go in there and edit. And we do have processes for getting results. So if for example, you or someone else were getting too broad, one of the things that the pre-interviewers know to do is to say, can you give me an example of that? And people have heard me say that in the interview.
Definitely.
Give me an example of it, it always brings the guest back down to a specific. Specific often leads to stories that are easy to visualize and make sense. So we did that with you, and we said, not just did you ever have any low points, because then you'd say, yeah, every business has low points. We said, do you have an example of a low point? And you said, last year we had cash flow problems.
Yeah. So we're an e-commerce business. We're designing, manufacturing, and sourcing a lot of our products, and then inventorying, warehousing a lot of those products. And we also are a high-growth business, going from $100K in revenue in 2011 to $1 million in 2012 to $3.4 in 2013 to trending out to $6 million this year, which is our goal for this year. So that all sounds great until you start diving into the P's and Q's of that. And so since a lot of our stuff is coming from overseas, it's actually very difficult to get supplier financing on that product, which that's what you need to be looking for. If you're running a business similar to mine, you know, very first thing is to look for supplier financing. So it's difficult to get from overseas though. And we're having to buy in container load quantities in advance of selling, you know, onesie, twosie items out to our customers. So the growth was really great, but last year, and it was actually about a year ago, we hit some really serious cash flow problems because we had been growing our inventory in anticipation of sales. And even while our sales are going up and up and up, they're not actually going like this. They're actually going, you know, big up, and then it'll be a little bit down, and then it'll be another big up, and then it'll be down, you know, maybe 2 months, and then it'll be another big up. So the trend line, if you put the trend line out there, the trend line is up, up, up. But the fact that you've got, you know, somewhat staccatic sales on a monthly, daily, weekly basis means that you're always trying to balance inventory for sales. This is a little bit dry. But the
it's not. It means, even frankly, that the more you grow, the more cash flow problems you have.
Yes.
Right? Even if you didn't have perfect up, 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 you would have to spend much more today to prepare for your growth next week, and then much more next week to prepare for the growth the week after that. And you don't get your money back until after the sale, but you do put your money out before you even get the product. It's a huge problem. This is why many people don't do this, why they frankly, they don't get into the space at all. What did you, first of all, how did you feel about it? Let's get into the emotional part of it, like we talked about earlier.
So I'm a pretty transparent guy, you know, sometimes to a fault. And I will say that up till now, this has been the lowest point of my entrepreneurial journey so far. So we were scrambling to pay the bills. We have a profitable business, had a profitable business. We had a lot of inventory on our shelves, but we also had bills because we needed to pay for more inventory, and we needed to pay to keep the lights on and, you know, the employees' payroll and things like that. So bills were stacking up, and we had had a couple of down months in a row, and this all contributed to a huge cash crunch. And at the time, I was the only partner who was managing our cash flow and seeing this stuff going on. And we also had very poor systems for anticipating what was going on in cash flow, or even anticipating, you know, kind of what sales we had in the pipeline and things like that. And so I was basically seeing that our bank account was just like running down, 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 even as our inventory was high. The bank account's running down, 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 down. And I was internalizing all of this stress, saying, hey, I've got a profitable and growing company here. How am I having so much trouble paying the bills? And I wasn't reaching out to my brother and my partner on that, because I was saying, hey, I'm, you know, 30 whatever years old. I've got an MBA. I've done this before. I need to solve this problem. I need to take this burden on my shoulders alone. And the result of that was I literally went into a depression. And the anxiety was such that I would wake up in the morning and just want to go to sleep at night. I would wake up, and when I'd go to sleep at night, my head would hit the pillow. I'd not be able to fall asleep because I was so stressed. And I'd wake up, you know, with like cold sweats in the night. I mean, it was really, really, really bad. But then in the morning when I go into the office, I'd have to put a huge smile on my face and, you know, show the employees, you know, keep my chin up. No, none of the employees even knew anything was wrong. And, you know, I'm just kind of like having a really hard time up here.
I've had that where I sleepwalk to work. All right, not here at Mixergy, but at previous company, there was a period there where I was basically sleepwalking to work. No one would know about it. I wasn't functioning well. What did you do to snap out of it?
So there are a number of things I did to snap out of it. And if you're going through this right now, the point is that you need to keep trying different, just as you mentioned earlier, try different things, double down on what works, and then kill what doesn't work. But here's what worked for me. So number one, I found to deal with the stress, I found, I guess, constant. Some people call it something that helped me get rid of the stress. And for me, it was lifting. Like I started lifting heavy and using that to deal with the stress. And every time I went in the gym, the stress would go away for an hour. And so at the very least, it would give me an hour to kind of clear my plate. I also started going to therapy to deal with the stress, which prior to this, I had thought that, you know, therapy was for, you know, weak people or crazy people or whatever. But now I'm a huge believer.
I went to therapy so many times, I got nothing out of it. I feel like they either tried to tell me what to do and they thought that they were really being helpful by telling me what to do, but I just wanted them to listen, or they would listen and not give me enough guidance. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was just tell me what to do without listening to me at all or giving me guidance without any awareness of who I was. What did you get?
So for me, and maybe I just have a good therapist or one that I mesh with well, she does a very good job of listening and kind of nudging me in this direction or that direction or saying, you know, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? But a lot of listening. And so I think maybe she, instead of me trying to spill this stuff out to my wife or talk about things that I would be, you know, ashamed to talk about with my wife or with other people.
Like what? What were you too embarrassed to say to your wife or too ashamed?
That I felt like the business was failing. I mean, I had quit my job, six-figure job that had extremely bright prospects to run this entrepreneurial business. I've got two kids, a wife who believed in me and still does believe in me, by the way. You know, how could I look her in the face and say, hey, this isn't going well? I mean, that's you know, a big part of my, or was a big part of my anxiety.
Being open about it somewhere, I guess, takes some of the weight off of your shoulders, but it doesn't make the cash crunch go away. It doesn't bring more customers in the door, bring more funding into your operation, and get your suppliers to somehow magically trust you with 40-day terms or longer.
Yeah, so I was dealing with the emotional part first. Now let's get to the like nitty-gritty of the business part. One other thing that was a mix of emotional and business, I joined EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and that was huge for me. So if you're not involved with other entrepreneurs that you have either a mastermind call with or a mastermind group or something like that, you know, definitely try to seek something like that out. But now into the nitty-gritty of what helped me out in the business. So first of all, a lot of what was causing a lot of the stress on me was the fact that I was seeing these problems like 2 weeks out, so not having a ton of time to deal with them. Like, oh, sales are down. Inventory's up. We're going to have a cash, you know, crisis in 7 to 14 days. Like that's pretty horrible.
So EO helped you understand that this was coming up so that you could do something about it?
Oh, sorry. So EO was a little bit of an aside. Like
the
having an audience or close group with other entrepreneurs who had been there, done that to one extent or another helped me deal with a lot of these individual situations. But the specific solution that I rolled in for my business, honestly, was fairly line of sight. So I won't say that EO helped me necessarily with that, but they did help me while implementing it. But so what we did is I created a cash flow document, which at the time was just in a Google Doc format that that actually forecasts our cash needs out by 2 months. And it weighs the sales coming in versus the money going out and estimates all this stuff so that if there's a cash crunch coming, we have 2 months of warning or more, depending on what time of year it is, than 1 to 2 weeks. And so if you've got a few months, you're then able to say, okay, we need to do something to pump sales in that short time, or we need to seek a bridge loan or something like that to make things work.
I see. So let me see if I understand this. Oh, sorry, what were you going to say?
So getting more visibility into our cash needs and then our incoming cash flows as well, and balancing those two out was huge.
So the therapy is what helped you get out of your funk so that you could be clear-headed enough to understand that there was a solution and then sit down with something as basic as Google Docs, create a spreadsheet, and sketch out what that solution would look like.
Correct.
And I think
I
might have
helped me get my head right so that I could operate the way I needed to operate and be 100% or as close to 100% as I needed to be in the office.
All right, I stepped over your response to what it was about therapy. Tell me what I'm missing here. It feels like part of it was just having someone who listened allowed you to unburden yourself, which got the weight off of you. It seems like also by talking to the therapist, you realized some of these things that seemed huge weren't as big as they were. And maybe, is that right? Or am I just imagining it?
Absolutely. And I mean, she helped provide a lot of clarity, some of the problems that I was facing. And then also, helped me to understand that I don't need to be Atlas holding that stone, the world on my back. There are other, my partner, other employees who can help in various different ways. And that's what they need to be doing.
I see.
So
unburden the negative and help turn your attention to what was working for you, what assets you had that you can use. Okay. Did I miss something? Because I don't want to be a know-it-all here with this answer and then miss something that I didn't actually know.
No. So a couple of other things that we did. I mean, again, the Google Docs was very line of sight. But after that, we didn't have a bank credit line. We didn't have any financing from the bank as of a year ago. And so we actually went, I went out basically hammer and tongs and said, I'm going to bring back a line of credit so that we can, get out of this situation as it moves forward. And based on beating the bushes for that, we actually now have many, many, many more options for financing inventory and financing different things, getting a bridge loan if there's any situation here. At the same time, concurrent, where I was looking for bank and traditional financing, I was also going to our suppliers and saying, hey, you guys see our growth rate. This is something that you guys can be a part of and help assist us to continue to grow and grow and grow. We're going to be loyal if that happens. Or you can, continue being who you are, which is a great supplier. Thank you very much. But we're going to need to see other options for suppliers who really believe in what we're building and are really willing to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and give us some longer terms. And I did this both with our stateside and our overseas suppliers and had a good bit of success with that.
I should suggest to anyone who's listening to this and wants to get more into this part of business, we don't talk enough as entrepreneurs about the depression that we feel, about the setback, how we have to deal with it alone. And frankly, sometimes we have to put a smile on our face because we have to convince people that they should continue to do business with us. There are a couple of entrepreneurs who I interviewed who are especially good at this, and I'd like you to go and listen to them as a follow-up to this interview. We're not done yet. There are a couple of other questions I want to ask Peter, but the founder of LivePerson talked openly about therapy and its impact on him. I really urge you to listen to it. Anyone out there, as a follow-up to this interview, really listen to it. Hear his words. It's available on Mixergy. Just put LivePerson into the search box and you'll see it. And of course, I'm saying of course, but now I'm suddenly, James Altucher. James Altucher on Mixergy talked about specifically even thinking about not just how to kill himself, but the actual plan for doing it. He's always very open. James Altucher, available on Mixergy. I urge you guys to listen to those as follow-ups to this if any of this is resonating with you. We started this whole thing out talking about wantrepreneur who starts a business. You did it. And I think I'm curious about, and I think the audience is curious about, how big you got it. What were your sales last year, 2013?
So 2013, we were aiming for $3 million in revenue, and we hit 3.4, had a very nice push at the end of the month. And then, as I alluded to earlier, our plan for this year is to do $6
million. So, were you profitable last year?
Yes.
You were.
So on $100K in revenue, when we didn't have salaries, but you know, it was just a side business, and that was in 2011, we broke even. We made a little bit of money in 2012 on $1 million in revenue, although, to be very honest, both myself and my partner were taking far sub-market salaries in 2012. And in 2013, again, profitable on 3.4. Still sub-market salaries, but not as sub-market as they were. So,
boy, I think there are a lot of people who are thinking, you know what, if he's depressed, it means the whole business is going to pot. There must not be any sales. Must not be profitable at all. But it's not. That's not the only time when we start to get down. All right, here is, I'm going to put it into Skype chat so you'll remember because you gave us so much. April in the pre-interview asked you, if someone wants to go and actually do it, break their inner entrepreneur, what advice do you have for them? And you gave her a list of things that I thought we can talk about together. Podcast was at the top of your list. Why podcasts?
So I started listening so at South by Southwest in Austin a few years back. I'd never listened to a podcast before, and I'd never been interested in listening to a podcast. But I met a guy, Joel Runyon from Impossible. Oh, shoot, I'm messing up his website. But there you go, Mr. Impossible. And when he heard I hadn't listened to podcasts, he gave me an impassioned, semi-drunken ramble about why it was so important to listen to podcasts. And apparently it made an impact in my brain. And I started listening to the Tropical MBA, and then from that, Seth Godin's Startup School. And actually, I think through the Tropical MBA, I actually found out about Mixergy. I think I maybe heard about Mixergy before, but not until the TMBA guys were into it. And it was a way, so listening to those podcasts was a way of quasi surrounding me with entrepreneurs and people who are going through some of the same challenges that I was going through, you know, without having to actually seek them out and find them. And so for me, it was really huge because it enabled me to, you know, supercharge the growth of my business and supercharge my growth as an entrepreneur. Plus, I could always listen to them in the car when I was on my commute to my corporate job, where, you know, maybe a mastermind call or something like that, I would need to be more present for.
And today, do you have your own podcast too?
I do. I have The Mistake Podcast, which you can find on iTunes or online at themistakepodcast.com, which is actually with Peter Shankman. And we talk to CEOs and entrepreneurs about their biggest mistakes that they've made.
The founder of Haro, Help a Reporter Out.
Exactly.
Nice partnership there. Why don't we do two other things from this list? The second item on the list I want to make sure to get to. You can read it exactly any way you want.
So I had been holding off cursing a little bit on the interview, but if you want me to read it,
I want you to just be yourself in any way you want, to any way that you think is important to get this point across, because it's important.
Okay. It is important. Fucking sell something. You know, convince someone to pay you $1, one penny, something for something else. And the reason that I'm so emphatic about this is that I think that that's the way to break the entrepreneur curse, is to go out and start duking it out in the marketplace and getting people to pay you for something. And this something could be a physical product. It could be an information product. It could be a subscription to a website or something like that, or a consulting gig, something like that. That's how you get out of this entrepreneur bog that, you know, might mire you down, is sell something to someone else, because that's the ultimate, you know, arbiter in entrepreneurship of success and failure. You know, somebody, well, I mean, there's profit, but but I mean, fundamentally, if you're able to convince Joe Schmo to pay you even a dollar for what you're offering, then you're going to be head and shoulders above, you know, everybody else who's a wantrepreneur.
And then it starts to really feel real to you. I mean, beyond the fact that you now have a dollar, and if you know how to get a dollar, you can multiply what you've done to get it, to get more. And frankly, the second dollar is easier than the first. But beyond that reality, there's the part in your head which makes it real. When I first saw on PayPal an alert go up that someone bought, I realized, yes, this is real. And now I have to make it real, because otherwise I make this guy a fool for buying from me. You know, I have to keep selling it. I can't start giving it away for free. All right, one last one. Personal life, the value of a personal life and the importance of it as an entrepreneur.
So for me, family always comes first. I mentioned that I have a wife. I've got two lovely, lovely, lovely daughters, and congratulations to you as well.
Just have first, but, yes.
But for me, it was when you hear these stories about, you know, the fabled stories about, you know, Steve Jobs, and I think he had to be sued to provide a college fund for his daughter, and you know, also was, you know, potentially not the nicest person to have around the house, although of course accomplished, you know, much you know, many great things. I never aspired to that myself. And when I went to business school, there were a number of CEOs who came in who were held up as paragons of success, but in every single speech that they gave to the business school class, these different CEOs talked about the negative effects that their success had had on their family. And whenever I was sitting there listening to that, listening to things like this, I, you know, made a mental note and I promised myself that that's not going to be me. So if I was going to be a huge success out in the world, but my kids wouldn't know me, and I do travel a lot, by the way, but I'm extremely present as a father and a parent when I'm around, and, you know, I'm FaceTiming and stuff.
And you made another point too. You said, look, if you don't have a stable personal life, if it's in chaos, it's going to make it so much harder to run a business. If you can't walk into work focused on your business because you have to focus on this argument and this other thing that's going on, it becomes really tough to focus on work and to channel your energy properly. True?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have a very boring family life, which I love. And it lets me have a tumultuous business life. You know, duke it out with suppliers and stuff like that.
All right. We started out talking about, if you're a wantrepreneur, you should hear this story. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. And I'm sure that if you listened to it, if you watched what Peter did to succeed, you'll understand a couple of things that will help you work, that will help you also break your inner wantrepreneur. And frankly, I'm not a wantrepreneur. I got a lot out of this interview. I'm going to close this off by suggesting that people check out your blog and giving your URL directly, in addition to saying that they should go to Fringe Sport. And the reason I want to give your URL directly is if they do what I just did, which is Google Peter Keller, you know what comes up?
Oh, no. I know what comes up.
There's apparently a murder suspect named Peter Keller. There's way too much stuff. Suspect. What's the blog?
So my blog where I talk about product stuff is productsimple.net. So just
productsimple.net.
Yes. And if you are Googling Peter Keller, no, I'm not the Peter Keller who killed his wife and family.
Hey, you don't look anything like him. I didn't even read the story, but I saw murder suspect and tons of posts. I said, I'm not even going to get to the Peter Keller I'm interviewing on page 3. All right, there's one thing that I really like about this site, about Product Simple. If anyone goes over to it, I suggest they take a look at the email script, the email that you use to send a factory, the one that's actually copied from what you use to get a supplier. And the reason I think that they should take a look at it is because it's so freaking practical. This is the way people need to email when they want to connect with someone, not these long-ass emails that really are way too complicated and force the recipient to try to spend hours reading them and try to understand what's in your head. This email just freaking makes sense. All right, productsimple.net is the blog. The website is Fringe Sport. And if you happen to be in Taipei or anywhere else in the world where Peter is, I hope you'll get to meet him in person and say what I'm about to, which is, Peter, thanks for doing this interview.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.